Okay, I'm sorry to drop late. Is this yours, friend? Thanks, I'll hang on to that. I'm sorry it's a bit late. I had to make an appearance in the Kutcher's Resort. So now I've seen the Catskills. And the bungalows, you know. This talk, I think, is on how to choose a marriage. Your marriage partner?
Yeah.
How to choose a marriage partner? There's nothing intellectual about this, okay? This is practical. And it's of relevance to everyone, because if you're not married, then this is certainly something you should think about. And if you are married, then you're probably going to interfere with your kids when they get to that stage. You might as well interfere correctly. So let's think through the rules and some of the framework of this subject. What's the correct approach to this issue? Perhaps we'll have the chance to talk about some of the themes of marriage as well, but let's try to focus as far as possible on the practicality of choosing a marriage partner in terms of an individual, in terms of a person who is, if you help young people, or you either officially or unofficially some sort of shadchan, you need to know some of these rules. There are many mistakes that are made in this field. Now, many people are insensitive in their putting together people for purposes of marriage, and very often they cause pain, and they feel that fraught with incompetence and difficulty. So let's try to think through that. There's another whole department to this talk, which is the Balshuva, the so-called Balshuva world, where the question of people meeting each other and setting up relationships has its own specific issues, benefits, difficulties. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer if I can. That's a field in which a lot of rich experience has been built up. Let me make a few remarks about the subject, and if you have any questions that I'm able to answer, I'd be very happy to do so if I can. When one talks about selecting a marriage partner, right, you're dealing with a young person who's dating, and they want to know what should they look for. How do they begin to approach assessing whether a person is the right partner for them? Then I think there is a set of criteria that time and Torah sources as well have shown to be valid. And let me share with you what I think is a correct program that in a sensible way approaches this issue. The way I see it is that there are two non-negotiable factors. And then there's a red line. And beneath the red line are a whole bunch of negotiable items. Non-negotiable means if you don't have those, one of those, you're in big trouble. Negotiable means depends on you, right? Depends on you. For example, what would be a negotiable? Let's make clear what I mean. When I say negotiable, I don't mean not unimportant. One of these negotiables might be absolutely critical, but not necessarily for you, right? For example, an example. The person you select in marriage should preferably be healthy. It should be healthy. But it's not an absolute requirement. Not absolute. Some people could not make a successful relationship where there's a real health challenge, and other people would be fine with that. I had an example where Tamari, do you think you could ask them to switch off their... If you go to the desk, they apparently can switch off the thing completely. I appreciate it. Thank you. If not, Rabbi Sushat will tell you how to do it. I personally had an experience of a young couple who lived near where I was at that particular time. And I used to see an ambulance arrive at the apartment virtually daily and take this young lady away for treatment. And after about a year, she died. She died. I went to see the young man, and he told me that 4 years before that, when they got married, she told him she had terminal cancer. He married her anyway. She lived for a few years and then died. And he told me it was the most wonderful 4 years of his life, and he's now looking to remarry. Now, not everybody's like that. Not everybody's capable of doing that, right? He had no second thoughts, no regrets. He knew exactly what he was getting into, the most fantastic relationship. That's not for everybody, right? That's a negotiable item. For you, that might not be a feasible option. For somebody else, that might be something they could take in. There are other negotiables that could be critical for some and not for others. A young man is considering a young lady, and she has a mother who's, let's say, problematic, right? The kind of lady who needs a place to park her broom when she visits, let's say. Well, that is, you know, I would class that as negotiable. For some young men, that might be absolutely out of the question. They could just not build a relationship with somebody where there isn't a warm, positive family. For some other young men, he would say, well, you know, we'll live in Alaska and pull out the phone and it'll be okay, you know. So that is a negotiable. So when I say negotiables, I'm talking about a situation where that factor might be critical, but not in an absolute sense. It may be critical for you, but for the next person it may be fine. Simple things like attention to neatness, right, might not bother you at all, but for some, marriages have broken up for less, far less than simply, you know, how organized or how neat a partner can be. I know a particular marriage, and I'm not going to say whose it is because my wife would she's not here, is she? Well, in a particular marriage that I'm thinking of, the husband is very organized, right? Always puts things in the same place. Surgical training, you know, you put a thing in the same place, you reach out for it, it will be there. The wife, he never puts a thing in the same place twice. Never. Right? I don't think I've ever found the keys in the same place. Now, potentially, that's dynamite, right? That's dynamite. You know, if you train surgically and you know you need to put your hand out and find an instrument and life depends on it, and you know, I'm the kind of guy who likes to know that the keys are in a certain place so that there's a fire and the whole place is filled with smoke, I'll know where the keys are, right? Well, she manages to find a creative new place, you know. So now, that is potentially dynamite. You know, how do you handle... Tamari, I'm not talking about Emma. I'm talking about a... you know, how do you handle that sort of situation? Well, I've, over the years, come to a method of doing it myself. I keep my keys on me, you know, all the time. And I have my own pen, my own scissors, my own, you know, I keep them in a secure location so that I don't enter the tension zone of having to go find a thing when I, you know, need it. So, you know, this is potentially these are things that I would put as negotiable because for some individuals they could be critical, for others not. So I think there's a hierarchy of factors. There's first of all factors that we don't even get onto the map of the discussion because they're absolutely essential, right? Here's a young man thinking of getting married. The prospective partner needs to be female, right? Female. Now, you're all from, so that's taken for granted. In the secular world, that's actually an issue. Actually an issue. Deal with young Jews now who come from places like Southern California. You know, they might want somebody who's neither male nor female, or both, or, you know, these can be challenges. But assuming you're talking about somebody who has all the absolute criteria, the fact is that they are of the opposite sex, that they are Jewish, that they are ostensibly able to have children, right? The young man considering getting married, if the young lady is known to be unable to have children, from a Jewish perspective, that's an issue because one of the mitzvahs in marriage is the mitzvah of having children. Not that long ago, a young girl came to speak to me who has a genetic problem where she has no ovaries. She has no ovaries, right? She's hormonally normal because she's been given, you know, hormone replacement. And she can carry a child, but she cannot conceive a child. She has no ovaries. So she came to ask me, I'd like to get married. What can I tell a prospective husband in terms of setting up a Jewish home? In other words, can I tell him that we can have egg donation from somebody else, and we then will conceive this child, I then will have it implanted into me, and I'll carry the pregnancy. Am I allowed to tell him that he fulfills his mitzvah this way? Because if not, he's not going to marry me. That's a hot, you know, breaking, agonizing question. In fact, it's not a simple matter at all. It's not the subject of our talk, but I researched the question thoroughly for her, and it turns out that that's not an ideal option at all. It's a big question about whether it's allowed in the first place, about whether he in fact does or does not fulfill his mitzvah. It's a very difficult issue. In fact, the solution that I presented to her was that what she should preferably try to do is find a man who cannot himself have children, or somebody who has children already who's lost his wife. In fact, the halacha is, the Gemara says, that the absolute priority of can you ask him to switch it off? Thanks. Can you switch off the air conditioning for us? Thank you very much. The Gemara says that if a man has lost his wife and he has little children, he's allowed to remarry in the first week of Shiva. not live with his wife, but marry, because the little kids need a mother. So I told her those were the options, and she, you know, there were tears in her eyes, and she set out to find one of those options, right? So if we're talking about the absolute requirements, are not on the discussion today, which in the film world is not usually an issue, then we're talking about the first set of criteria, which are two absolutes, not negotiable, and then a red line, and then we talk about the negotiable issues. What are the non-negotiables that you require in marriage? The first of them, I think, is that there be a natural attraction. Attraction, chemistry, call it chain, call it chemistry, call it physical attraction, it's all of those. This is something that is essential. It is the factor that we put first, not because it's the most important factor, but because generally speaking it's the easiest to assess up front. After a couple have met a few times, not necessarily once. Sometimes you meet a person, they don't particularly appeal to your taste, but after a few times, person grows on you. But after they have met a few times, four or five times, whatever it is, if there's absolutely no, what they call in the secular world, chemistry, right? Not chemistry, it means just not, then this is problematic. This is problematic. One of the major issues where you run into trouble with this, which again is not necessarily directly our subject, is in the Bolshevik world. In the Bolshevik world, there's often such a frum approach to things, such an extremely frum approach to things, that this is just left out of the discussion entirely. Right? when I was in yeshiva, a young man came to me and he said, he's dating a certain young lady, can he sit down and talk about it? So we went outside, we sat on the grass, we started talking, and he told me about this girl. She was absolutely incredible, stupendous, intelligent, and frum, and you're a shemaim. You know, she could have been Mrs. Mashiach, you know, she was like really. And after he gave me this whole long description about how wonderful she was, I said to him, and do you like her? And he said, no. I said, you know, this is a wonderful, good-looking, charming young man, you know, who was being so frum, he was only looking at this checklist of, you know, these frum requirements. You know, that's not a recipe for success in marriage. Marriage hard enough at the best of times, that's not the way to approach it. And therefore, you need, the Gemara says, at least according to one opinion, that a man has to see a woman before marriage, because if he doesn't see her, and then he marries her, and she doesn't appeal to him, then there could be a problem with fulfilling the mitzvah of, right, it's an issue. Funnily enough, the Gemara says that for a woman it's not an absolute requirement. Women have more, generally speaking, more maturity in this area, and women, fortunately for most of us men, are able to put up with a lot more, yes, and adjust to a lot more than a man might be capable of, and very often that works. However, sometimes it's an issue in that direction as well, and this has a few applications. And an extreme example I can think of is where a young lady came to see me once. It was a Saturday night, it was a Shabbat, she came to my house, and she said, I have the following problem. I'm getting married next Sunday, right? 8 days from now, to this most wonderful young man. I admire him tremendously, I actually knew the young man, tremendously admire him and so forth, but I have to admit that I'm not physically attracted to him. It's an issue. And now that it's getting close, I'm having to deal with this issue. What should I do? I said to her, this is the time to make a decision. You either call it off now, or make a decision that you can go through this and never look back. She thought about it very carefully and decided to go ahead. They separated on their wedding night. Okay, she was unable to go home with him, and that's when they got divorced, and that was the end of it. So this is an issue. The other application, of course, is where the couple, you know, find each other attractive, and then right after marriage, one of them, usually the man, stops paying any attention to his, you know, to his appearance and to his, you know, here's the pattern. He's for 18 years before he started dating, he never wore a clean shirt. Now you know he's dating because his shirt's clean and he started smelling like a flower. And first time his love, he's combed his hair, you know, and now, you know, he gets married. And then he ceases paying any attention to that. That is not a respectful way to handle a marital partner. If you need to pay attention to your fitness, your appearance, and so forth, it's a sign of respect and it needs to be maintained. So this is an issue that works in both ways. It's also an issue where people involved with young people should not apply pressure. I've been involved with many situations where usually a young man was contemplating marriage. He had a problem. The problem was the shape of a girl's nose or some problem. He felt it was going to be an issue. He went to a certain Rebbetzin, Shadchan, Rosh Hashiva, who said, don't worry, this will not be a problem. And married the girl on the basis of his and then enter the problem. And in fact, in a situation of immaturity, the person sometimes gets into a cycle where they can't see anything other than the problem. I had association with a young man who came to see me once. He told me that the problem was that he'd been married for 6 months. What was the problem with the girl? She was perfect in every way, but she didn't look like his mother. She did not look like his mother. That was the problem. Okay, that was the problem. So when he started dating her, and my wife and I knew this girl, she was a fantastic girl, absolutely wonderful young lady. He felt he wanted somebody who looked like his mother. Okay, nice compliment to his mother, but that's what he wanted. What happened was, she was a wonderful young girl, perfect in every other way. So his Rosh Hashivah said, look, that's an immaturity, don't worry, it'll disappear, and marry her. Well, he married her. What he can think about was the problem. He used to come and sit on my desk and put his head down and cry. For months, he used to come and see me every day at lunchtime and cry. After a few months, they got divorced. Divorced, why? Because she didn't look like his mother. You know, now, there are many faults in that scenario, but one of the faults is a Baal Eitzah, somebody who advises a young person and pushes them into marriage, where there is, you see, the Rosh Hashivah was right. This is an insignificant problem. And with a little more maturity, he could have, but he wasn't mature enough to handle it. And what happens in that scenario is, a couple of months down the line, the person says, I didn't want to be here. You told me to marry them. You told me to get married. This is a central reason why, when you advise younger people, you must force them to take responsibility. To push them into marriage, right? Because you think it's going to be good. When there may be a problem, and the problem's compounded by the fact that they're not taking responsibility here, is a recipe for disaster. There are occasions when you can do it. For example, in London we had a young man who was involved with us in the Kirov environment, and he was engaged to the most fantastic girl, and they were obviously perfectly suited, marvelous couple. And as the weeks approached his marriage, he started to get the cold feet syndrome. Yeah, I'm talking about severe, lying on his bed in the fetal position, like crying for hours on end, you know, hysterical. But it was clear to all of us that it was not any problem with a young lady. It was his fear about getting married. He didn't have a father, he'd lived only with his mother, he was absolutely traumatized at the thought of having to leave his mother. And it was clear that the girl was not the problem. On the contrary, she was in every way like his mother. And it was obvious that she would be fine. We carried him to the chuppah. We carried him. His feet didn't touch the ground. Two of us stood on either side. We carried him to the chuppah and we held him up, you know, as unobtrusively as possible so that he didn't keel over as he stood there shaking and trembling. His mother, most fantastic marriage, and, you know, they're okay. So occasionally, when good judgment, you know, detects it, you might need to, if that doesn't work, a shotgun is also useful. But, you know, generally speaking, the guideline is they have to take responsibility. If there's a problem, many youngsters these days are not mature enough to handle the problem. Very often, after that situation, they see only the problem. A young man came to me recently to ask whether it would be permitted to pressurize his wife to have cosmetic surgery. Okay, because he's fussy about a particular... I mean, you know, okay, so you're dealing with often, you know, this kind of situation, and the physical attraction or the chemistry is a very important element that needs to be maturely handled. Now, when we talk about attraction, we're talking about the first criterion of the non-negotiable criteria. How attractive does a person have to be? After all, there are different degrees, right? You might meet somebody where you find them very attractive and they sort of take your breath away. You know, well, how breathless do you have to be? You know, does it have to be like life-threatening asthma, you know? Or it's just sort of a mild breathlessness, you know, like what degree of... Well, I think the criterion over here is that in the area of attractiveness and chemistry, there's also a red line. And the red line is the line of neutrality. In other words, there's certain people that you meet and you find them very warm, the chemistry is positive, you enjoy being with them, there's no problem of awkward silences, it's just a natural appeal. And there are other people where you feel a bit awkward being in their presence. You feel that, you know, they just don't speak to you, and the thought of being close to them would not be attractive. The partner needs to be above the red line. Above the red line. How much above the red line? That's not, depending on the level of maturity of the people involved, that's not such an issue. But it must be positive. When somebody tells you that they have a problem, and they feel awkward, and they don't want to be close to the person, that is problematic, right? Many young men have the problem. They come and they say to you, look, the girl is fine and attractive, but like not as much as somebody else. Okay? That is a much less of an issue than when they tell you that there's a genuine thing. Many young men, incidentally, if you really scratch beneath the surface and you find that he's complaining about the girl's looks, very often what's really bothering him is not his feeling about her looks, it's what he thinks his friends will think. Men, ladies, I'm sorry to have to tell you, can be very immature, and there's an issue. Also in the secular world, there are many other, in the Balchiva world, there are many other issues that impinge too. In the Frum world, you know, there's very much less opportunity for comparison, and you just have a whole different mindset. In the Frum, in the secular world, where there may be many previous relationships and many jaded experiences, you know, it can be a completely different story. Very often young people are dating where there's a lot of tremendous emotional engagement that's gone on beforehand. Their comparisons, many relationships, very often people have lived together with a partner perhaps for years before they have become firm and engaged. It can be very messy and very complicated. And therefore that needs wisdom in how to approach it, and I'll try to speak about that just a little bit more. In the very firm world, you know, it's a different story. I remember meeting an individual who was brought up in Meir Shearim. When he came to South Africa, he told us about how he got married. And I always tell the story to the Balachiva just to show them that this is not what we are. How he got married was when he was 18, his father walked in one day, this was in Meir Shearim, and he said to him, "Nachum, put on your Shabbos clothes." So he said, "Why, Abba?" So his Abba said, "Never mind, just put on your Shabbos clothes." So he got dressed in his Shabbos clothes. His father walked him across to a house in Gula. They walked into the house and his father said, "Nachum, say hello to your kala." So he said, "Hello." And they said, "Mazel tov." And then the men had a party in one room, and the women had a party in another room. And on the way out, his father said, say goodbye to your colour. And he said, "Goodbye." And his father said, "No, not her. So he said, "Oh, goodbye." And they walked out. And that was the engagement. That was the engagement. What turned up with that marriage was that after a couple of years of marriage, they had not been able to have children. And they went to the Chazon Ish for a brocha. The Chazon Ish gave them a brocha for Chai Banim Chaim. And a few years ago, they had their 19th. Now, that is not, you see, but the problem with the Baal Tshuva is he thinks that is him. The Baal Tshuva is more verfrumt than... Yeah. So the Baal Tshuva thinks that, like, that is what he is. And she also thinks that is what it is, and they aren't. So the Baal Tshuva needs to be... Yeah. And therefore, one date where you sort of say, you know, Mazel Tov, and that's the engagement, is not normally suitable for the average Baal Tshuva. But this is with regard to the criterion of chemistry and mutual attraction. Let's talk about this. Are there any questions about that? Let's talk about the second criteria, which is far more important. Nu, what would you say is the most important quality besides the natural feeling?
Natural behavior.
Yeah, I would say... Yeah. Well, we're assuming she's Jewish, right? You mean mutual... Okay, that... Yeah, but let's talk about it like this. The second criteria is what we would call midas. In other words, the raw human material. Okay? The raw human material. Not intellect, not frumkeit as such, not, you know, secular qualifications and tastes in music and whether you like spaghetti and she like, you know. Those are issues, but nothing stacks up as importantly as raw human material. What's going to come through at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're in pain and money's tight and all sorts of issues are there is a person who knows how to cope, knows how to deal with life, is happy, is a giver, somebody psychologically normally, and that's what you're looking for, is somebody who is balanced, happy, psychologically stable, somebody who smiles, above all else a giver. Above all else a giver, right? Your typical South African. That's a very good. Indication. But that's what you're looking for. If the person is the opposite of all that, if the person is psychopathic, twisted, hung up, depressed, etc., then you're in trouble. Unless you are psychopathic, twisted, hung up, then you'll be fine. That reminds me of the sadist and the masochist who got married. You know about that? The sadist and the masochist got married, right? Marvelous, right? As soon as they were alone together and the door closed, the masochist turned to the sadist and said, "Hurt me." And the sadist said, "No." That, of course, is the perfect marriage, right? But what one is looking for, above all else, is that quality of personality, which is solid, genuine personality, above all else giving. I remember once a young lady went to Rav Simcha Wasserman and asked about a certain young man. He asked one question. He said, "Does he smile?" That's all he asked. Does he smile? That's all he wanted to know. So you're talking about a person who is of genuine human material. Levels of Frumkeit, for example, often work very well. You see, we see this all the time in the Baal Tshuva world. When one of them is very frum, or knowledgeable, and with a lot of background, and the other one is not, the main issue is not the level that should be the same. Main issue is the mutual respect and heading in the same direction. Very often a person who is very raw and very new, but very keen and moving up, is a much better bet than somebody who is very firm and knowledgeable, who is really stagnant or moving down. That is the issue. There's another whole problem here with married couples where one becomes more firm than the other, one starts moving ahead, another one wants to hold back. It's a major issue in the whole cure of world. But that's another issue. So what we're saying here is that what a person should not... Very often young people come and they say to me, look, what should I be looking for? And they rattle over this whole long list of, they've made all these criteria. Top of the list is, non-smoker. Non-smoker. Okay, important, likes, Italian food. This is not the way to go about it, right? The way to go about it is there a natural connection? That's absolutely essential. And then, is this a good person? Is it a good person? After that, you can talk about tastes and compatibilities and commonalities of various types of things, which obviously may be critical, as I said before. But I can't think of anything on that scale or spectrum that could not conceivably be put into the negotiable items. Whereas natural attraction and the fact that the person is a good person with the wholesome qualities that you need in order to make a wholesome and meaningful, warm, dynamic relationship, that is something that is irreplaceable. Some young people make the mistake of thinking that that will develop later. That's a very unsafe bet. Very unsafe bet, right? Thinking that you'll marry somebody and sort of convert them and make a mensch out of them. Theoretically, it's possible. The Gemara says that a man has no hope of doing that with a woman, but she has every hope of doing that to him. That means the Gemara talks about married couples where they married couple that split, and in each case, the one who is reformed in the image of the woman. That means the woman can take a king and make a shmata out of him, or she can take a shmata and make a king out of him. She has that formative power if she uses her chochmas nashim, as it's called, bonsobesa, the wisdom of a woman who can build her home, and by positive reinforcement. Men generally do not take very well to criticism. In marriage, a woman's biggest error usually in marriage, men have a long list of errors that they make. Women usually make just one. They nag. Okay, and what hurts worst is they nag when they write. Okay, that's the problem. They pick out the real problem and they nag at it. That's not the way to handle a man. You have to make a man he thought of it himself, right? You can make a man think he thought of the thing himself. You don't tell him what to do. You have to construct it in such a way. And when he does think of it himself, then you tremendous admiration. You treat him like a hero. This is the way to make a successful marriage, right? Women think that they'll make a man successful by making demands, right? Making demands for what he should do. No man responds to that. You have to bring it out with a warmth. And a young girl came to me and she said, I could see she was on the verge of a breakdown. She had big black rings under her eyes. She was shaking with exhaustion. What's the problem? The marriage is almost finished. Why? Because they have tensions. Money's tight and he works hard and he pays no attention to her and he thinks she sits home painting her nails while he's out working. All the classic areas. So I said, and how do you handle that? So she said, well, look, in order to make him understand how hard I work, he's got a new baby that keeps her up all night, I make sure that when he walks into the house, I'm busy with the baby and supper's not ready and I look terrible. This is the way I make sure so that he sees I've had no time for anything else and I don't look up when he walks in so that he can see I'm working hard. I said, and is it working? She said, no, he's about to leave. So I said, look, one of you is going to have to break the cycle and it has to be you. And here's what you do. You take, before he comes home, you take a bath, you look your best, you make sure the baby's sleeping. Woman has to understand, when a man comes home from work and he's had a bad day and the whole world has beaten him down and taught him that he's useless and he's starving, there's only one way to handle that, right? The way to handle it is you line up all the children at the door. This is what you do before he walks in, right? Keep him there for half an hour, it's irrelevant. Have them standing at the door in order of height with fixed smiles on their faces. At the end of the line is the spaniel with his slippers. And as he walks in, you give this cheer of jubilation and total admiration and you carry him to his chair. You put him down, you take his shoes off, you massage his feet, you bring him a whiskey. That's how you have to handle it. Right? After you've done all that, then you can, then you can offload your trouble and you can, But even then you have to do it like he's the strong shoulder to lean on, not like complaints, like advice. See, women have to know how to handle, when you get married, you have to tell a bride, the first thing you ask for, the first gift, what's the most important gift that a young bride needs? A freezer. the freezer. And the day after your marriage, you cook the most fantastic Shabbos meal and you put it in your secret compartment in the bottom of the freezer and you tape it up. That's what you do. Because you have to be prepared, you see. On that disastrous Friday afternoon, when everything's gone wrong, and the kid's been bitten by the dog and needs to be taken for stitches, and your marriage is, you know, then last minute you whip it all out from the microwave. Fantastic, right? Sunday morning you do it again, put it in the freezer. That is how you, key to successful marriage for a wife is to be prepared. Be prepared. What's the alternative? Wake up in the morning late, hit the ground running, panicking, screaming, yelling at everybody? No. You do it like all you ladies do. You wake up at 5. You have your beauty bath. You watch the sunrise with Pacific serenity. You have your health breakfast, don't you do that? You meditate. You sit in each one's bed and wake them with a gentle, loving mother's hand. Isn't that how you do things? And after they've all left the house, you collapse, right? That's what you do. But it's a question of preparation, and that's how you handle it. Anyway, these are some of the tips that you you need to get. But the main criterion here is a decent and good person. Now, the challenge here, obviously, is how do you assess that? How do you assess that the person is? People aren't always what they appear and how they put themselves across. Well, in the first category, in terms of attraction, that's relatively easy. After all, I've met a few times, and for those of you who work in Kiruv, I'd mention as well, just, you know, what's very interesting is that very often the secular person will say to you, if dating is such a formal and stiff affair in the frum world, you know, it's all organized and there's never any, you know, meaningful contact and it's all, how do you know you're really compatible with a person? And I often explain to them that, and this goes down extremely well with very feminist, you know, secular women, is that the Jewish approach is a very feminist approach. After all, the woman has to be dressed in a feminine fashion. She can't wear man's clothing, but she has to be modestly covered. So the man has to look at her as an entire being. Can't only look at her as a physical entity. He has to look at her so that the relationship gets going without being sublimated into the physical aspect of the relationship. And there has to be a mutual respect and a judgment of the person. As well. It's a very feminist type of idea that appeals very strongly. So that that and other issues also are geared towards making this successful when it's handled correctly. When it comes to assessing whether the person is this good person that is compatible, that has the qualities of character, the key here is enough time spent with a person. Again, as I said before, you brought up in a society like you know, the ultra frum, you know, Yerushalmi type situation where, you know, she's going to shave her head, you know, at the chuppah, and she's going to wear thick black, you know, stockings, and she knows he's going to be just like her father, and he knows she's just going to be like his mother, and they've both been davening in the same shul for the last 350 years. You know, there's a virtual guarantee of so many issues that mesh together automatically that there's not that much left in terms of their own assessment of each other. When you come from a secular world where there's tremendous differences of outlook and of previous experiences, especially in the Balshiva world, it takes a lot longer. The question is, how much longer? Well, the first step is the background assessment that very often can be done even before the people meet. For example, what is the family history? What is the family story? Is this a person with a long history of stable relationships and a loving family and a long-term job and signs of stability? Or is this a person where there's a lot of fragmentation and fractured background? You walk into the house and there's blood on the walls and human bones, you know, like, you know, in the closets and you know, dangerous objects, you know, flying. That doesn't bode well, you know, for the child's sense of their own, you know, stability. So checking out the background is important. The Gemara says a young man should consider the girl's brothers, right? Because his sons are going to turn out like her brothers, right? In terms of mirrors. There are issues that need to be checked here. But yeah, it's good news for some of us and a little worrying for others, right? But there is a certain amount of background thing. In the Balshiva world also you have unique issues here because many Balei Tshuva come from backgrounds that are fractured. The reason is that in the secular world today, the norm is for marriage to be in trouble. You know, in some Jewish societies now, the divorce rate is quoted as more than 1 in 2. Right? In Southern California, for example, or even in South Africa, which is a very old-fashioned and stable and normal type of place, the divorce rate is very high. So in the secular world, you're dealing with a person that doesn't have a frum background. Very often there is trauma, and now it's been shown very elegantly and very well in psychiatric research and in sociological and psychological research, that people tend to repeat the patterns of their parents. They tend to repeat the patterns of their parents, and not only that, when there's been a trauma in a child's life, before the age of 15, more or less. In other words, a child who suffered the death of a parent, or the divorce of parents when they've been 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, very often leaves an important scar. When a person is 16, 17, 18, and the parents go through, there's some sort of a tragedy in the family, very often it doesn't scar the core personality. But when a child's 6 or 7, or 3 or 4 or 5, and a father dies or leaves, very often that little girl will have trouble trusting men permanently, or trusting Hashem for the rest of her life. Very often that can be problems. This is a well-known issue, and it needs to be taken into account. Sometimes, of course, a child goes through those experiences and comes out tremendously strengthened. The classic example of people who turn out to be strengthened by those sorts of issues, again, happens to be in the Bolshevik world. Very often, a person comes from a background where there's been a traumatic divorce and a lot of difficulty in the family, and what happens is that the normal pathway would be for them to look at their parents with anger and frustration and have trouble in life working through those issues. What classically happens in the Bolshevik world, the person looks at their parents, instead of looking at them with anger, they look at them with pity and sadness that the parents didn't have more Torah values that would have prevented those issues, and they model themselves on a particular role model family. I can think, for example, in Johannesburg, of a particular Frum family that many dozens and dozens of young people went through their hands in terms of their being a role model. When I say went through their hands, I mean actually moving into the house and living there, if not for years, for months. Because they came from a difficult background, non-Frum background, they were taken into that home, and they will explicitly tell you that the role model they see as their marital role model is that particular family. And in many cases, it has this tremendously strengthening effect and a very idealistic effect, and it works very well. But these are some of the issues that one sees that the thing. So the first question is, what is the background? What are the background issues? Nothing bodes as well for a young person's mental health and stability as a warm, loving, intact family, you know, where there's been care, concern, you know, that's worth its weight in gold in almost an inexpressible degree. The second factor is enough time. The couple needs to date long enough, okay, that there aren't going to be surprises later. Now, how long is long enough? Well, you know, the Frum thing is, you know, after the third date, there's already a lot of pressure. And the pressure doesn't help, by the way, because it makes it much harder for them to see objectively and to decide. Rabbi Gottlieb says he always tells the boys in the yeshiva 8 months. 8 months. He says no one ever listens, so he says 4 months. Okay, you know, but you're talking about enough time that you actually get to know each other. So the first criterion is enough time. The second criteria I would say is enough time that there's no new information coming in. When a young man tells you he's been dating this girl and he's not sure about certain issues, there's not been enough time. Enough time needs to go by that even things he hasn't discussed with her, he would know what her attitude would be. Yet you can't let a couple get married where it turns out that he's intending to have 25 children and she wants to be sterilized, you know, and they never spoke about it before. You know, you can't do that, right? They need to have a commonality of understanding, and it takes a certain amount of time to get to that. If I took anyone in this room and I said to you, what would your father say if he saw the following scene and I described some scenario, you would be able to tell me the very words your father would say. Why? Because you know the man. You know how he approaches the world. You know what his attitude is. You know him. When a couple get to the stage that they actually know each other's attitudes and responses, and they've been through difficult times, and they've been, then there's no point in continuing, okay? At that point, what happens is the procrastination and the delay is non-functional. When a young man gets to the level where he can tell you certainly that another date is not going to bring him any new information, that is the time to split or to get engaged. But prior to that is premature. When he's not actually sure what her responses are, how can you actually tell? Well, it's useful to meet in different circumstances, right? Particularly when you meet in circumstances where one perhaps is under pressure. Let's say you've seen the person when she's not feeling well. She's seen him when, you know, she should invite him to eat dinner with her family, and she should get her young brother to spill the soup in his lap. You know, this is a very useful test of how he will respond. You know, you do that sort of thing that it really endears you to the, you know, to the family, and you see what are the responses under various circumstances, so that you know when you get engaged to this person, there are not surprises in terms of what their attitudes and responses are. When you get to that stage, how long does that take? It depends. Depends on background, depends on commonality of cultures and various other issues. But when you get to that stage, then the couple need to be told very clearly, not pressure, but this is the time to make a decision. Yeah, from here on in is only a question of, very often it's the young man as opposed to the young woman who needs a little extra time. Men often have this, they've got this inflated sense of their own self-worth, and no matter how wonderful she is, you know, he's always got this thought that maybe somebody better, you know, is out there, you know, waiting for him, and how, after all, how can you disappoint all those young, you know, beauties out there that would love to marry him. You know, so you need to sort of put up, pander to that male issue. But after you have gotten through that, that is considered to be enough time. So these are the two issues that are, I would say, are not the negotiable issues. Below that, you have a whole bunch which we can't possibly have enough time to discuss, which are the negotiable issues. I just mentioned a few of them, but it's only by way of general introduction because there are an endless number of those negotiable items. One of them, in fact, is compatibility. For example, cultural backgrounds can be, and I pointed out because although it's negotiable, sometimes it's a hidden factor that the couple does not take into account. There are certain cultural backgrounds that tend to go very well together, and there are certain cultural backgrounds that tend not to go well together. For example, I'll give you a couple of examples. A situation that often does not go well together is a girl from, let's say, an American background or South African girl with a very ethnic Israeli. Okay, very often they are, and I'm talking about the people from very frum backgrounds, often it works well. But when they come from secular backgrounds, another potential disaster is a young man from a gentle culture, like let's say an Australian or a South African, who gets engaged to an Israeli girl who comes from a secular background. Okay, that's often a very threatening situation. After all, you're marrying this girl who's used to settling arguments with an Uzi, who's been brought up with a very independent-minded culture. Often that can be problem. We've seen a lot of problems in that sort of area. Cultures that go very well together are, for example, a South African man or an Israeli man marrying a European or South American girl. Because in Europe and in South America, women have a natural sense of femininity and knowing how to gracefully submit to a man's needs, and that often works extremely well. A girl brought up in New York, and I don't mean to be personal in any way, but a girl brought up in New York, especially from a very wealthy, privileged background, can be very difficult sometimes, okay, because there's a very strong sense of independence, of feminist demands. Often there's a misunderstanding with the girl from that background, with a boy, even from a distance as close as the Midwest. Okay, there can be a disparity in culture. A boy from St. Louis, okay, even though it may not be that, I don't have to tell the New Yorkers among you that New York has a certain I always remind, once when I was younger, I saw the picture of a New Yorker magazine, the cover of a particular New Yorker magazine. Yeah, it had what they labeled as a map of the world. The first half of the picture was Fifth Avenue. 90% of the rest was like the rest of Manhattan, and then they had sort of like Europe was like a thin, this thin kind of thing, and like Africa wasn't even like registered, so like that was like the New Yorker's map of the world. Like, you'll hear a New Yorker in another country saying to his wife, "How much is that in real money? How much is that in real money?" So you have this kind of mindset. So culture is an important issue. As I said, if you're lucky enough to marry a South African, then of course this is irrelevant. But those are issues. That's one important hidden card where there can be a gap. When people come from the same culture, and the sort of boy next door, the girl next door, very often many issues are a certain commonality and a certain automatic understanding in terms of taste and sense of humor. That can be important. There are other issues too. Money is a big issue. Money is a big issue. How money will be handled, what financial... Only this morning a young man came up to me and said that he's engaged and his fiancée, he can tell she's anxious about money. That is potentially a disaster, right? The Gemara itself says that when monetary problems arrive, peace in marriage leaves. Okay? So money is a big issue. One of the critical issues with money, of course, is to reach an agreement beforehand about how money will be handled. One of the classic breakdown areas in money in marriage is where a woman spends, it's usually the woman who's spending, when the husband's earning, and she goes over the limit, and he has to pay for it, and it goes, that's a potential disaster. The couple needs to decide beforehand how money will be handled. Separate accounts, which he reaches the end of a bottom line at the end of the month, and there is no more, and it's adhered to. They need to make an agreement in terms of, you see, why this is so important is because the halacha is in marriage, that the division of authority is clearly defined, right? The Gemara says that mili d'shmaya, things that are halachically definitive, are in the man's domain. I'm not talking about kashrus and taras mishpacha, which are the woman's domain. I'm talking about things that are more specifically, halachically determined, the man's supposed to make the final decision. Mili de'ara, which means that the practical matters, the woman's supposed to have the final say. When that authority is split that way, you have a tremendous recipe for peace, right? If the man's making all those, it can get complicated, of course. They say that. They asked once Mrs. Salanta, right? Rabbi Saul Salanta's wife. They asked her, does your husband, in fact, follow that rule? So she said, well, no. What he does is he always shows me how everything I think is mili de'ara is really mili d'shmaya, and then he decides. Okay. But the point is, when you have this division of authority, you have a tremendous cushion for tensions. Money is not really defined. So they need to make a clear division of how the money will be handled, otherwise there's going to be tremendous resentment and tremendous pressure, and that is an issue that needs to be clarified beforehand. I was associated with a young couple in England who had tremendous potential, both incredibly capable and promising young people. They actually got engaged, and shortly before their marriage, they called it off. Why? Because they realized that although they were tremendously compatible on every level, they had one serious disagreement. He was very carefree about money, and a total emunah that Hashem would provide every month, and she felt she absolutely needed a budget that could be seen beforehand, that she'd know she'd be taken care of, and there would not be. And that disagreement, they could see with great wisdom, would be a total disaster in their marriage, and they separated because they knew they could not agree on this issue. She would be under such tension, not knowing where the money was coming from, while he breathed in saying, don't worry, it'll be okay, that they decided they had to split. So this potentially can be a thing. Commonality of tastes and compatibility often is tremendously misunderstood as being a critical issue. Often a young person will say, you know, but we have such tremendously tastes in common. Or they'll say that this is problematic because we don't have tastes in common. That's not an issue. Tastes in common is not an issue. Mindsets in common is not an issue. As long as there's mutual respect, I can say confidently that the best marriage I ever saw in my life, was between two individuals who were completely and utterly different to the nth degree. Completely. The man was an engineer. Okay? I never saw him function, and I knew him for many years, I never saw him function without total logic. Even in the most immense screaming emergency, he would solve the problem like an engineer with total cold logic. The woman, I don't think, ever had a logical thought. Ever. Okay? She's an artist. She's an artist. You've got no logical component at all. It's all the most incredible marriage. Total and absolute admiration and respect for each other's capacities and capabilities, even though no common competence at all. In addition, they always used to keep the bedroom door locked. It means the children knew that there's a zone of privacy that's sacrosanct. And the children also will tell you that they saw that for each of them, clearly the other came first, not the children. The children knew that I treat her like a queen, she treats me like a king, we come first, you come second. Not that there isn't dedication and love to the children, but an amazing degree of admiration and mutual respect, and even though totally disparate in terms of abilities, processes of thinking, etc., but tremendous mutual respect. So the fact that you have to have the same musical taste or like the same kind of food is not an issue. Not necessarily an issue. And so you can move through all the things. I've had many couples come and tell me, only last week a girl came and told me that I cannot marry this guy because he wants to live in Manchester. He insists on living in Manchester. Usually it's living in Israel. That's usually the issue. I have to live in Israel. That actually has halachic weight. The Gemara says that you can sue for a divorce with the full payment of the ksuba if she doesn't want to live in Israel, and if you live in Israel and she wants to live in Yerushalayim, you're obliged also to, you have to oblige. That means to go from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim is a halachic obligation. Now, it's wise not to let your marriage collapse, okay, because you want to do that, but technically speaking, there is way to that. However, a couple should have the sense to see that whether you live here or there is not nearly as important as the deep issues of compatibility, but marriages have failed or failed even to get going because of a prior knowledge that Manchester is a particular challenge. Have you ever visited Manchester? Mm-hmm. Manchester is a, you know what Mark Twain said about Manchester? Mark Twain said he hoped to die in Manchester because then the transition wouldn't be as noticeable. Like, you know, if you died there, you wouldn't notice the change, you know. But okay, that's the issue. Anyway, I think I've spoken long enough. Are there any questions on any issues that we touched on that I can... Yeah.
Commonality of goals is not the negotiable.
No, no. You see, what do you mean? Commonality of goals in terms of raising a Jewish family, Yiddishkeit, Torah, etc. You have to have a certain commonality here, right? Because this is a core issue and a fundamental issue. However, technically speaking, if you want to be extreme, it's negotiable. Because I've met couples, and I've seen couples be very successful with a complete disparity of goals, but respect for each other's goals. The classic scenario is where a couple's married, and one becomes a Baal Teshuva. I've dealt with many families who are married. One becomes a Baal Teshuva, and the other one digs their heels in and says, and not only that, accuses their partner of being... That means you didn't marry him on this basis, okay? You aren't the person I married. You become a complete... And you expect me to comply with your things. In many cases, we've seen successful marriages, even though there's an extreme discrepancy in terms of it. Why? Because they agree to be mutually respectful. Each one caters to the other, okay? Usually, Taras and Mishpacha is the problem. That's usually where the problem gets going. Kashrus, usually, they can work out an agreement. Even Shabbos, with enough tolerance, can be worked out in terms of an agreement. Yeah, but when you force me to something like... Yeah, this can be an issue. But obviously it's wise to have a commonality of goals. And the place where we really struggle with it is when that discrepancy in goals is set up after a marriage. It usually is an issue beforehand because they are, especially in the Frum world, and especially in the Baal Teshuva world, the thing at the top of their list, in fact, will be rightly or wrongly, commonality of Frum goals. The classic area of application here is, the question is, he wants to learn permanently, or she wants him to learn permanently, and the other one has reservations, maybe he'll need to work at some point. A young man approached me this morning, the same issue, is that he wants to learn for many years, she's anxious about that. What will come first in his mind, the learning or taking care of her? And that's a real and genuine issue. A woman needs, it's written in many halakhic sources, a woman needs to know that she's going to be, that's a basic need for a woman, to know that she's going to be provided for, in context of what her social environment involves. That means, yeah, many women will do just fine with almost nothing if they're living in a community where most people have almost nothing and they're living very idealistically. But you take a woman like that and you put her in Manhattan where everybody has a leather lounge furniture and like all, and she doesn't, it wears her down, it can be an issue. You need to be extremely idealistic to put her into that circumstance. These are issues that need to be seriously taken into account. Yeah. Are there any other... Yes, please.
In the spiritual world, taking into account two non-negotiable,
yeah,
as you call it, you don't find, I don't think I've never done a study, but you don't find necessarily a higher rate of marital problems, divorce, separation, things like that, yet you don't find that they have clearly the dating process to see how to prove out these two non-negotiables.
This is a question I'm often asked, and particularly... with a medical background, I've worked in the secular world as a doctor very intimately with people, and I've worked in the very frum, you know, world in Yerushalayim, as you know, as a doctor very intimately. The facts are like this: in the what you call the very frum Hasidic world, let's say, the divorce rate is rising, and intimate problems are also rising. There are many issues. Throughout the frum world, problems are creeping in, okay, that you didn't have 20 years before. In fact, in Kiruv, it's very applicable, because in the Kiruv world, 30 years ago, you needed no ideology. All you needed to say to the person, let's not argue, come and see our experience, come and see our life. Well, all you did was bring him to shul. The first night in shul, they get 10 invitations for Shabbos for the next 10 weeks, and any home they went to, it was an absolute model. There was no spouse abuse, there was no alcoholism, there were no drugs among the kids, there were no kids dropping out. It was an idyllic environment. All the person did, especially in South Africa, they came in, they say that, they saw that sort of a life. They knew the alternative was likely to be problematic. Before you even gave them any shear room or discussed any ideology, today it's not like that at all. Today, if a person goes into a frum bookshop, you'll find books on spouse abuse, drug problems, teenagers dying of overdoses in the frumest of environments, kids bombing out and rejecting Yiddishkeit. It's a big issue. It's a small percentage, but it's high profile, and it's known, and it's growing. Okay, so marriage is no longer, no matter which community you look in, secular problems are creeping in. However, still, they are much, much better than their secular equivalent. Now, the reason for that, this is a long discussion, probably the reason is that in what you call the Hasidic world, let's say, the probable reason for the compatibility and the success of marriages is manifold. One is, there are no previous comparisons. The Hasidic young man is brought up to be awkward in the presence of a young girl. On the contrary, the Baal Teshuva has had many experiences, relationships that he has to get out of his head. It's a big issue. The young man brought up in a Hasidic world, right, has never been, he doesn't know, you know, he's never put money in a girl's hand, right? If he collects stock at the door, she has to put it on the floor, he has to pick it up. He's been trained to be awkward in her presence. So So there's none of that. There's also tremendous commonality of the model of what they will look like and what they'll do and what their home will look like and what they'll be striving for and how they'll be doing it. Tremendous commonality. Especially if you take a Hasidic group from the same sort of enclave in the same sect and the same... There's a tremendous commonality of goal that already sets up a very... There's also the issue of divorce, okay, is just not on the radar screen even. I'll give you an example. I stayed with a family in Westchester, not far from here, in Hastings on Hudson, many years ago. I'll never forget this experience. I met the couple, they hosted me for a few days. Jewish couple, wonderful, wonderful people. I walked into their living room, and they both looked out the window, and the husband said to me, every single home you can see from this window is divorced. That means you can see the whole neighborhood, right? And they've made a calculation that in every single home you could see from their living room window was it, or he himself had been divorced, this was his second marriage. The woman told me the following thing when she was out of the room. She said to me, you know, when I got married, I had to make a decision. My decision was I got, she was a very intelligent lady, 3 university degrees, very, very intellectual lady. She said, when I got married, I had to decide, am I going to further my academic qualifications and have a qualification and have a profession so that when I get divorced, I'll be able to support myself? Or was I going to sacrifice all of that so that I could dedicate myself to my children as I wanted to do? But if I dedicated myself to my children and gave up all my academic abilities and aspirations, then the overwhelming chances that I'd end up divorced, and then I would be destitute without a way of supporting myself. That was her ordeal. In the end, she decided to not go for the academic criteria and forgive herself to her children. She did that for many years. Later, when the kids were grown up, she went and did her university degrees and so forth. It was a heroic decision for a New York woman to be able to dedicate herself to her children and her family, okay, in the face of the facts, which are she probably would end up without a husband. As it happened, the marriage was wonderful, you know, and it worked out. But that is the kind of mindset you're coming from. You're talking about a world where the complete opposite is the case. Also, where there's been no comparisons of relationships before, it's just a whole different kind of a sharing where there's a total focus and giving everything that I have to you, past, present, future. It's just a completely different mindset in terms of somebody who, you know, has had many relationships in, you know, and many comparisons. It's just a whole completely, completely different issue. Finally, I'll say this to you. Many youngsters from the very cool and liberal world will say to me, but if I never lived with this lady, how do I know I'm going to be compatible with her? How do you? The answer is only one fact. And the fact is this. Virtually all secular couples getting married today have had a full experience with each other before. And they've often lived together, if not for months, then for years. Very often without any view to marriage. My wife and I dealt with a couple who came to us after 11 years of living together. That means they met when they were 18, they moved in together, and they lived together for 11 years. After 11 years, she mentioned marriage, and he disappeared. Marriage? Like, who's talking about marriage? Huh? She gave the best years of her life on the basis of a commitment without... this is what's going on, okay? So they've lived together like that. And what are the divorce rate? The divorce rate after couples have lived together is over 50%. And in some places like California, it's quoted as 2 in 3. 2 in 3 marriages among people who... Yeah, where people very seldom get married. That means you have to understand that those who are committed are really committed. That's what's happening. In the Frum world, where there's been no contact at all and no sharing anything before, the divorce rate's almost zero on all levels, intimately, etc. Right? What's the reason? The reason is the completely different set of values, comparisons, exposure to media, exposure to all sorts of artificial, there are many sociological and psychological factors that make it in the Valtuba world is a unique world that's got its own issue.
Simple question. Are there people who shouldn't get married?
At all?
At all.
I mean,
let me throw it to the
past. Yeah.
The friendly women obstetrician,
yeah,
who says that they firmly believe that some people should get married.
Yeah, yeah. The question is, are there some people who should not get married?
Period.
Who should not get married? Period. It's like a certain man called his rabbi. And he said, Rabbi, I have to speak to you. Rushed into the rabbi's office and he said, look, I think my wife's trying to poison me. What should I do? The rabbi said, let me speak to her. The rabbi called the lady and he spoke to her for 3 hours. Called the husband and he said, take the poison. Okay. So there are those. Okay, yes, please.
I've heard you speak, and it seems to me that you advocate that the woman to most of the accommodated, because that is their nature. That does not sit well with me.
Are you from New York? Are you from Southern California?
No, Chicago.
Chicago, I see. The question is that I implied that the woman often has to be the one who's more accommodating and has to bend and be flexible, and not so often the men. In my experience, and I don't claim to be an expert in this field, and I don't claim to be an expert on the North American experience in general, in my personal experience, women are usually more able gracefully to do that. Okay, men more often are threatened by the ego issue of having to... And in my practical work with couples over many years, I've found that when a break has to be made, and there's a standoff, and there's an ego issue and a pride issue, very often if you can show the woman that if she's prepared to change her methodology in a particular way, it will lead to a love and a thriving relationship. Very often they have the largeness of character to do that. Very often a man, even when he sees it, has this immature, self-destructive kind of thing that I'm not going to be forced into. Very often, I may be wrong.
No, you're right. Absolutely.
And so... Anytime. Yeah, if you come from, if that's your background, if that's your where you are and that's where you come from and it works, then why not? Why not? But if you don't come from that background and force yourself into that, is usually not wise. Is there one last question that I can... Yeah.
Given the style of education that young, strong girls are educated and brought up in,
yeah.
And when you meet, they're meeting a potential sitter.
Yeah.
They're looking to find this menstrual kind that you described,
yeah.
This warmth and this giving. Yeah. The method of, still amongst the film world, the way that they're educated to interact,
yeah.
Is not along those lines. Many times a person can get the sense that this is not a person that smiles, and yet they may really be, but they never can get there.
Yeah.
The woman can really go and bring herself to get to that point.
Yeah, it is an issue. The issue here is, how do you, when people haven't had the education to... There's a certain modeled education, let's say, in certain corners of the film world where it's very hard to scratch beneath the surface and really perceive the warmth and the... It really is an issue. It really is an issue. Sometimes you deal with stereotype backgrounds. We had a tragedy recently in London with a girl who comes from a very, very extremely from background, from a community that's particularly narrow in its outlook. And she's 40 years old and not married. 40 years old, she met the most fantastic Gary Tzedek. I know him personally. He's the most incredible individual, person with an amazing history, one of the most remarkable people I know. And she clicked instantly with him because he's a remarkable person. And they went out for many, many weeks, and finally it broke down because she just could not take her family's... That means her family was so... Her family told her they'd said shiva because she's marrying a non-Jew. How can you think of his parents who are not Jewish touching your children? Okay, and eventually she cracked, right? She's 40 years old, and he's an incredible person, and he's got 100% more Yiras Shamayim than anybody I've met in the film. He's an amazing individual. Okay, took us on voluntarily, and he's very, very strong. Fantastic person. She tried and tried and tried. She declared that she was prepared to go it alone and against her parents, and in the end, she just could not do that, right? So, these are the issues. Okay, one question on a good note, something positive? Yeah.
I've heard the advice. Well, I guess it's more for a girl than a guy, but date until you hate him.
Date until you hate him.
Would you say that, like, you should meet someone to see, like, how long would you give chemistry to come? Like, should you do this at time, or should you really do it until you, like, can't stand the person?
Date him till you hate him. Look, yeah. Could you speak to me privately before you get... Are you from New York? Oh, I see. Okay. I see. You'll have no trouble. Okay. No, I think if what you mean is until you see through all the layers and you have some genuine sense of the person underneath, I think that's essential as far as you can.
I don't...
I personally feel that less than a few weeks is usually inadequate. It's just very hard to see somebody relaxed with their hair down, when they're prepared to be open, when that newness is worn off. I don't see how it can be done in people with a secular type of a background. I'm not talking about an ultra, so-called ultra-Orthodox, you know, model. It's very, very difficult to do that. Obviously, it has to be tailored to, you know, to personal situation. But okay, so thanks.